RadioInfluence.com. The future is now.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Dark to Light podcast with
Frankie Val on the drums and
Beans. So we just did an hour with Dr. Zelenko. We didn't really have to say anything.
Well, I certainly didn't.
Well, I mean, you could have. You did once. Well,
I know. You took 95% of my questions. I had one more I could have asked, and then it was just like, hey, I had one more I could ask, and then he's just like, I got to go. But it was a great, great, great hour. It really was.
I mean, yeah. Holy moly. I wasn't expecting that. I was actually surprised myself. I was surprised.
Indeed.
So without further ado, listen to this amazing hour-long interview with Dr. Vladimir Zelenko, the kind of, what, would you call him the founder of the HCQ theory? I don't know.
I guess so. The progenitor.
Yeah, that's a good word. Yeah. And share this with all your friends. This was great. So we are joined today by Dr. Zelenko, somebody that we have wanted to speak to for a very long time. And we're really excited to talk to you today, doctor. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tracy, for having me.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've been one of the key figures in this COVID sort of nightmare, but in a more positive way, in my opinion, because you were the first one to really kind of raise holy hell about hydroxychloroquine. You treated hundreds of patients with success with hydroxychloroquine. So I'm going to do this a little different. I'm curious, what made you start using that medication? Like, what were you experiencing in practice at that point in time?
You know, they say necessity is the mother of all innovation. And what I mean by that, I'm a family physician, board certified in family medicine for the last 20 years. And I was working in my community that I served for 2 decades in upstate New York, a place called Curious Joel, New York, or it's in the village of Monroe, New York. It's around 35,000 people that live within a square mile. That was my community that I practiced medicine for. For 2 decades, and in the first week of March of 2020, COVID arrived, and it spread through the entire community at an alarming rate. And within the week, we had thousands of sick patients. And just to bring you back to that frame of mind at that time, to really understand what happened, you have to kind of put aside everything you know and just go with the chronology of discovery. And then you'll understand the answer to your question. So back then, there was no treatment. You remember, the whole world was emphasizing building respirators, ICU beds, and hospital capacity, and there was zero emphasis on pre-hospital treatment or interventions that could mitigate the course of the disease to prevent people from ending up in the hospital. All the emphasis was treating people once they were there. And no emphasis was on treating people before they got critically ill. There was emphasis on spread prevention, you know, isolation, shutdown, all that stuff, lockdown. But once someone got sick, the message we were telling patients, go home. When you get sicker, take Tylenol, drink a lot of fluids, go to the hospital. In the hospital, if you get sick enough, we'll put you on a respirator. And in New York at that time, 80% or more of patients on a respirator were dying. That was the treatment model that all medical professionals around the world were being told to follow.
Hasn't really changed much.
Parenthetically, yeah, you're right. The NIH guidelines as of today, if you look at their website, they say don't treat COVID unless the patient is in the hospital with an oxygen level less than 92. Just my commentary on that is that in all the evidence-based information that we have, all the medicine decision-making that we can use based on peer-reviewed studies, state that if you treat someone within the first few days of the onset of symptoms, which is what I was the first in the world to advocate for that, and I developed a protocol that actually made a big difference. My data showed an 84% reduction in hospitalization and death. Out of 600,000 dead Americans, we could have prevented 510,000 from even going to the hospital, just to give you a sense of scale.
Wow.
And that hasn't changed. And all the data that has come in from dozens of peer-reviewed papers all corroborate my initial observations, which is not surprising because I didn't really come up with anything new. You know, it's pretty pathetic when common sense is considered genius. I mean, you don't need to be a genius to understand that the sooner you intervene in any process, any disease process, let's say cancer, obviously you're going to have better results with cancer if you treat someone when it's in one place than when it's spread all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to be a doctor to understand that.
Yep.
And same thing with infections. It's much easier to get rid of any infection when it's localized or it's a small fire instead of a large fire. So that's all I did. I just applied a principle in medicine that was there for millennia and then just used it to in a new disease. Whereas as of today, you still listen to our governmental experts, quote unquote, they're advocating policies of death. They're advocating for you to do nothing, miss the crucial window of the opportunity to treat and intervene to prevent the complications. And they're only advising you to treat the complications, not the infection. It's a policy of a government that wants you to die.
I mean, you can't say it any more plainly. It's obvious and it's true. I like, what made you choose hydroxychloroquine? Did you see some promising studies out there? Did you talk to peers? Like, how did you choose that medicine? It's just, it was an off-label use, obviously, but what made you pick that?
So I'm not sure what your religious background is, but I can tell you I was praying to God because it was 2 o'clock in the morning. I had hundreds of patients that I've treated for decades. You know, these are family members to me in a sense. And they were looking at me for help. They were dying, many of them, and there was nothing I could offer them. It's a very unsettling feeling to have people dependent on you and looking for you for help, salvation in a sense, and you have nothing to tell them. So I was in the middle of the night kind of praying to God, help me out, because I don't know what to do. And a video came to me. It was sent to me by email by someone. And I can tell you exactly what it was. You can look it up. It's on YouTube. It's MedCram episode 34. MedCram was a very high-level lecture series for medical professionals, and it explained the mechanics of what's called zinc ionophores. Everyone focuses on hydroxychloroquine, which is important, but really, if we have to look in a step back, a more general mechanism of action to understand what exactly is going on, because that's important, because when government interferes with access to life-saving medication, you need to be nimble and find options, alternatives. And if you understand how hydroxychloroquine works, you can exploit that mechanism from other compounds as well to get the same result. That's an important idea because I'll develop that later. But so I was watching this episode of MedCram and explained that zinc inhibits RNA viral replication and does it in a very specific way. I'm not sure how medically astute your audience is, but I'll speak on a doctor level just in case a doctor is listening.
There are plenty, so you can speak at a very high level.
Right. So there's an enzyme inside this that's actually coded in the viral genome itself. The virus comes prepared with its own information to make copies of itself. So what happens is that the RNA, the mRNA code that's in the vaccines, but also the virus itself, carries information that's very important. It carries information of the viral genome itself, including the spike protein, but it also carries information for an enzyme called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. And that's important because for a virus to grow, it needs to make copies of itself so it could spread. In order to make copies of itself, it needs to make copies of its genetic material in order that it could make a new virus and pass it like an offspring to other cells. And in order to make copies of your genetic material, you need a certain enzyme. The virus needs a certain enzyme, which it comes prepared with. It has its own code.
So what happens is once the virus gets inside your cell, it actually harnesses your own cell's metabolic machinery and produces an enzyme called RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. That is extremely important because the virus cannot spread if this enzyme is not working. It turns out that zinc blocks this enzyme. It's the monkey wrench. It actually inhibits the functioning of RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. The problem with zinc, it's a bullet. Zinc is a bullet. It really shuts down this enzyme, kills it. The problem is that the bullet can't get to the right place due to biochemical reasons. If you know, zinc is a charged ion. It's a charged element. And what happens is when it's in solution, water has a charge also. It's polarized. And so water completely surrounds the zinc element, the zinc molecule. You're going to say, so what? Well, that's a problem because the cell membrane is made out of cholesterol or fat or oil. Think of it as oil and water. Now, oil and water don't mix, which means that the zinc, which is surrounded by water, cannot get inside through the cholesterol-like cell membrane, biphospholipid it's called, and it cannot get inside the cell. So what does it matter if I have a bullet if I can't get the bullet in the right place at the right time? It doesn't help me. So it turns out that there are zinc delivery systems. There are what's called zinc ionophores. There are substances that allow and facilitate the transfer of zinc from outside the cell to inside the cell. Again, that's called a zinc ionophore. It opens up a zinc transport channel. So that's the gun. See, if I give you an unloaded gun, you're going to tell me it doesn't work. That's not a reasonable conclusion. The reason why it doesn't work is I didn't give you the full set of what you need. You need bullets also. If I give you a bullets and no gun, you're going to tell me it doesn't work. Same answer. But only the synergy of the two, only when you have a gun and a bullet do you have a functioning system unit that you can actually do something with. Same thing with zinc and zinc ionophores. Why do I bring this up? Because one of the most powerful zinc ionophores is hydroxychloroquine. That's how we get to hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine is nothing more than a zinc delivery system. And it opens up a channel, allows for zinc to go inside. And so is ivermectin. And so is quercetin. And so is EGCG. These are very important ideas because there are two reasons why people die from COVID. Only two reasons. One is the moronic doctor that you choose, because what the doctors do is they delay treatment. Total malpractice, total like Nazis following orders type of stuff, where they send people home. People, desperate human beings, are coming to doctors saying, please help me. I don't want to get sick and die. I don't want to have blood clots. I don't want my lungs to get napalmed and destroyed. And the doctor says, okay, go home and wait until you die. So it doesn't make sense. So you only have a few days with the onset of symptoms when we can intervene and prevent this disaster from happening. So the moronic doctor who's practicing voodoo, not medicine, is essentially sentencing you to death. That's number one. Number two is the government you live under, because the tyranny that we're experiencing, the medical tyranny and the more societal global tyranny that we're seeing, blocks access to life-saving information and life-saving medication. So even if you do have a good doctor, but your government is obstructing access to medicine, then you're screwed. So there is a way to circumvent that. And this is really one of the reasons I do these interviews, to inform the public of their options. And some of these options, believe it or not, are over the counter. And you don't need your doctor's prescription. You don't need your government's permission. We'll get into that. But
until they ban it like they did with NAC.
Well, that's how you know it works.
I know.
But listen, I have a whole contingency plan. They're going to have to ban everything before we run out of ideas. But there are ways of really making a big difference. Nothing's 100%, that's for sure. But I can almost guarantee that we can reduce the risk of hospitalization more than 50%, probably closer to 75%, if we use over-the-counter strategies, which is important. And it could circumvent and prevent a tremendous amount of death. So that's how I came up with it. I basically, I looked at what other countries did. I looked at
South Korea, and they were using hydroxychloroquine and zinc in hospitalized patients. Not the best outcomes, but then again, they were using it in hospitalized patients. Yeah. And then Didier Raoult in Marseille, France, the famous doctor there, was using hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin in the lab and in hospitalized patients with some results. But my perspective is completely different. My perspective is keeping people out of the hospital. I'm an outpatient pre-hospital doctor. My predisposition has always been preventive medicine or early intervention and preventing all the complications from ever happening. That's the best disease is the one that never happens.
Right? Yep.
And so that's always been my predisposition in medicine. And unlike the hospitalist doctors who really await for patients to get sick to get to the hospital. So I decided, okay, I see these strategies. They make sense to me theoretically. I know that if I intervene early, it's going to get a better result. So let's try to treat people earlier. So I made a cocktail of these really three substances, zinc, hydroxychloroquine, and azithromycin. By the way, I never claimed it's the best approach. I only claimed at that time it's the only approach.
Well, it was the only approach. It was.
That's right.
I mean, I remember the day that I saw you were screaming about this. Somebody brought you to my attention very, very, very early, probably in March, April, when you first started going public with it.
I'll tell you exactly what happened. It happened March 21st. Mm-hmm. The reason why I tell you that exactly, I made a video to the President of the United States. With the help of my son, what happened was after a dozen or two dozen patients or so, and I saw clinical improvement within hours, people's breathing was starting to improve. I looked at this and I said, what's going on here? I didn't believe it myself, honestly. I had the same reaction that everyone else has when they first hear about it. Like, what? It can't be. It doesn't make sense. The big doctors at Harvard couldn't figure it out. Yeah. And they couldn't. And they had the wrong approach. And they still have the wrong approach. And after 50 or so patients with the same pattern, everyone was getting better. I said, you know, this is something. By way of analogy, I just found, I'm a frontline soldier, found an enemy map, and the enemy map has all the crucial information that can help win the war, but I need to get that information, intelligence, to the five-star general in the right time frame in order that we can win the war and minimize casualties. So how does someone with no connections get to the highest levels of government? It's called YouTube or social media.
Yeah, pretty much.
And with the help of my son, I had never made a video before. So I made a video addressed to the president asking for help. And this is when the story becomes unbelievable, except that it happened to me. I wouldn't believe it if it didn't happen to me. Mark Meadows, the president's chief of staff, calls me on my cell phone 16 hours later. And he said to me, Dr. Zelenko, I heard you're looking for the president. I said, yes, and this is why. I told him everything I just told you. They were extremely interested. I had the contact information to the chief of staff of the president of the United States, whose office is right next to the Oval Office. You understand? And every few days, I would give him updates, and he would respond. And in a sense, I was communicating directly with the most powerful man in the world, indirectly through his chief of staff. And then I after a few hundred patients, I sent a letter to the president, giving him a summary of my observations and my recommendations for prophylaxis and treatment. And the president made an announcement that he's taking hydroxychloroquine.
And that was it. That was it. It was all over once that happened.
Yep.
But do you remember what he said afterwards?
No.
That he got a letter from an upstate New York doctor advising him about what he was seeing and his recommendations. And that was the basis for his decision to take hydroxychloroquine himself. That was how I found out that the president got my letter.
That's how it usually happens. They never get to you and tell you they saw.
And I couldn't believe it. And that's when all the craziness started. Once the president announced his support for it, that's when all the opposition against hydroxychloroquine, which is unprecedented. It's a 65-year-old drug with a safety profile that makes it safer than water.
Doctor, you took down the Lancet. You literally, you have to look at it from that perspective, right? I mean, The Lancet was basically discredited as a fine medical institution because of the study that they did because of what you had found. Like, indirectly, you were responsible for exposing them.
I never looked at it that way. I contributed to the revelation of the truth, which obviously whoever took the false narrative approach got burnt by it. Actually, we got burned by it. It's the innocent people that got hurt. But yeah, The Lancet was a big, we'll get to it, but Lancet was a big, big problem. And it showed the coordination of the corruption between academia and politics and media, social and mainstream, and industry. There's this very well-coordinated movement here between industries to achieve a certain nefarious goal, which we'll describe as well. But that's how, that's the answer to your question. That's how hydroxychloroquine came to my consciousness. Once I started using it and I saw remarkable clinical improvement, I went public with that. And then, by the way, after Mark Meadows called me, then Stephen Hahn, the commissioner of the FDA, called me a few days later. He got me in touch with the head people of the NIH, which was a dead end. They had no interest in dealing with me or with my information or real world evidence. They were used to pharmaceutical industry and clinical trials and academia, and they didn't take seriously the information that I had, which all probably facilitated the death of hundreds of thousands of people. And then Rudy Giuliani called me, and I did a podcast with him, and that went viral. That was a life-changing event for me because it took me from obscurity to a world stage and a level of media scrutiny that I'd never even imagined, and abuse, a level of abuse that I'd never even known was possible. And but nevertheless, the information started getting out there, and doctors and hospital systems, and actually eventually governments started reaching out to me. I've advised, I think, 8 or 9 governments at this point, and to help them set policies both for treatment and for prophylaxis. And I'll tell you a very cute story that no one knows really about. The first country that reached out to me was Honduras. I don't know why, but they're a country of 8 million people. They only have around 1,000 doctors. And their president and minister of health, through someone who reached out to me through a translator, set up a meeting. And I explained to them what I was doing, just like I explained to you. And they were so interested that they set up a national compulsory meeting where they in-service their entire medical system, which is only 1,000 doctors, but they taught the entire medical system of early pre-hospital intervention with variations of my protocol. And the reason why that was important is because Honduras is a very, very poor country, which means that they didn't have enough respirators, they didn't have enough hospitals or hospital beds. So that means that anyone who progressed to lung complications died. So they figured out very quickly that the only way that they're going to prevent a disaster is by early intervention and not letting it progress. So this turns out to be a disease of wealth, affluence, because it's really the poor countries that have no other choice, that rely on the cheap old methods of treatment that had the best outcomes. The richer countries like us, we were looking for the fancy remdesivir, newer drugs, respirators, hospitals, and so on. And we ended up getting much worse outcomes than even third world countries because of the lack of emphasis on pre-hospital care. So what gets really interesting is that President Trump gave a news conference, that this is a matter of public record, and he mentions that he just spoke to the president of Honduras, and they're seeing tremendous outcomes with early intervention with hydroxychloroquine. And I was laughing because, I knew the backstory behind that. So, and there's a lot of stories like that I could show you. There's no doubt at all that anyone who has any shred of integrity, any brains, any goodness in their soul, that if the evidence is out there that early intervention, treat early, is the key to overcoming this crisis. And it's the key to circumventing the fear and the isolation and the lockdown, which is exactly why these measures are being censored.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you a couple of technical questions real quick, if I can, because I'm just I would love some clarification on this. So you've got hydroxychloroquine, and there are several different ways I've seen this sort of like RX'd, right? So, or TX'd, I should say. There's, you know, you need a load if you're doing prophylaxis. So you need to take it once a day for 5 days and then once a week thereafter.
That's my protocol.
That's you. Okay. So I've seen a bunch of different ones. So that one, can you explain to the audience why that's important? Like why you can't just take one a week, why the load is necessary?
Well, I can give someone 1,000 milligrams in one day. Each pill is 200 milligrams.
Yep.
And hydroxychloroquine has an extremely long half-life. It has, I believe, 3 to 4 weeks half-life, which means, half-life means the amount of time it takes to eliminate 50% of the drug from your system. And the different drugs have different half-lives, just like radioactive isotopes. They also have, we measure it by half-life. How long does it take for 50% of what we have now to go away? And there's a principle in pharmacokinetics that it takes 3 to 4 half-lives to get steady state levels. In other words, if you're aspiring to a certain level of medication, in order to get to that level in a steady state, meaning constantly, you need 3 to 4 half-lives. So that's important. So it takes around a month to get to steady state levels, maybe a little more even, of hydroxychloroquine. Now, we don't have that much time when someone's sick. We may have it when we were trying to prophylax someone, but why would we want to extend their period of vulnerability? So I figured out that if we load the person up, we'll give it a loading dose, again, and that's a famous idea in medicine, we can bring the person up to therapeutic levels of the drug quickly. But there's one problem. If I would give 1,000 milligrams in one day, and it's safe, but people got nauseous, they started throwing up. So I thought to myself, okay, I need to load them up in a non-urgent set, in a non-urgent way. How do I do that without causing people to feel sick? So I just looked at normal standard dosing. See, hydroxychloroquine has been used for 65 years for many diseases. And some people, including children and pregnant women, live on 400 milligrams a day for their whole lives.
Yep.
For rheumatological.
Rheumatoid arthritis,
malaria prophylaxis. So I knew that 400 milligrams a day is tolerated well by most people. This I knew because it's not a new drug. That's the beauty of repurposed meds. We know safety profiles. We know their pharmacokinetics. We know about them. It's just about figuring out new novel uses for old drugs. But since I know how this drug works, so I said, if children could tolerate 400 milligrams a day, most likely anyone could tolerate 200 milligrams a day, right?
Yep.
I said, okay, if I want to load someone up with 1,000 milligrams relatively quickly, well, how about I do 200 milligrams a day for 5 days? That was my rationale.
That's perfect.
And it worked. And yeah. No one was sick. People were happy. And I got people to therapeutic levels within a week. And then how did I come up with once a week dosing? Well, that's exactly what we use for malaria prophylaxis.
So,
malaria prophylaxis is once a week. Yep. And people, billions of people have used it over 65 years. So I said, okay, that seems to work. Let's try that. Again, keep in mind that this was all uncharted territory. This is battlefield medicine. This is improvisation. There was no, people complained to me that I did something that it was not based on clinical trials. And I look at these people, I say, you're morons, you're imbeciles, you mental retards. This is a brand new pandemic with no clinical trial history. And yeah. I'm the first one on the front line trying to innovate and figure something out to keep people above ground. And you're criticizing me for that? That there was no clinical data? I was generating that data, you morons.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. I mean, none of the people you're talking to right now follow that mindset, I'll tell you that from firsthand.
Well, that's a year and a half or 18 months into this. At that time, the false narrative and the media spin made that anyone who would dare think outside the box as a villain. You see, if you were a order-following automaton, Pavlovian dog, who just did what everyone else said, you considered a good doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that led to the death of hundreds of thousands and millions of people. Now, if you took a bad doctor like me, who dared to think outside the box, who actually cared about his patients and wanted to keep them alive and saw amazing results with God's grace and tried to share that information with others, that may be a bad doctor.
Well, I'll tell you this. In March and April, when we first learned about this and you and the work you'd done, I kind of chuckled to myself because I have a very close family member who takes hydroxychloroquine every single day for lupus. And we looked at each other and we just kind of said, well, wow, that's a blessing, isn't it? Like, we've got it right here. Like, because they were starting to ban it and they were starting to, I've done a lot of work with Joey Gilbert, whose parents were saved by hydroxychloroquine and, you know, all kinds of stuff. The other technical question I have for you, you reached a lot more people than you realized. There were a lot of people coming for you, but you've saved countless people by even just speaking out. I want to tell you that. The other question I have, so quercetin, natural supplement, probably no one had ever heard of before COVID or people who had didn't share it with my friends. How does that work in comparison to hydroxychloroquine? Does it work as efficiently, less efficiently?
Let me tell you the story behind that, and then I'll answer your question. So the first week of April, I was in New York. So I really was the only one in the state that was doing it. And so my practice and a few of my colleagues, friends that I was able to influence, we're following this paradigm of early intervention. And we were all saying the same thing. Anyone who did it, that's how I grew such a degree of confidence in such a short period of time, because it wasn't only me. I was able to influence, there's a Dr. Rose Joseph from Hackensack and other prominent physicians that were came on board and they tried the same approach as I did, and they were saying the same thing. So that helped build my confidence in the approach, because if it's not only me seeing it, then maybe there's even more merit to it. Keep in mind, again, this is all new discovery. And then Cuomo, the ghoul, I call him a ghoul, he's killed more people than the most prolific serial killers in the history of America combined. He killed over 20,000 nursing home residents directly. And so that ghoul issued an executive order blocking access to my patients. And again, because I was the only one essentially doing it in the state, to hydroxychloroquine. The pharmacies stopped dispensing it. So all of a sudden, I had tyrannical governments. Really the first time I became painfully, consciously aware of a real tyrannical government. I mean, I heard of it in other countries. I came from Russia myself, so I grew up with stories. I was little, but I grew up with stories of tyranny. But I'd never, at least that I'm aware of, came into contact with such overt tyranny. And now my patients, I would write a prescription, and my patients would go to pharmacies, and they couldn't get it. And so that didn't help my patients. So I said, what do you do when you're obstructed by government? You innovate. And so I started doing more research, and of all places, on the NIH servers, I found papers talking about how quercetin, together with vitamin C, functions as a zinc ionophore or zinc transport channel mechanism, which is exactly what hydroxychloroquine was doing. So honestly, I didn't know what quercetin was. So I Google it, and I see that it's over the counter, and it's a derivative of apple peels, roots. I said to myself, my God, do you know what I think I just discovered
is the cure, not to COVID, but the cure against tyranny. Because now I could say, Tracy, listen, your government sucks, but you can go to the vitamin shop. You can get courses in vitamin C, you get zinc and vitamin D, which I'll explain later. And now you have a very effective strategy to prevent and treat early COVID. So that's how I became aware of quercetin. That's why you became aware of quercetin.
Yep.
It's because of FOMO. And we have to send them flowers, the ghoul.
Well, you've got something much better now going on there in New York. Yeah, much better.
So it's that's how that idea evolved. Now, you ask me which one's better. You know, they say there are three elements to any successful career in any field. It's availability, attitude, and ability. The three A's. Now, what has it helped me if hydroxychloroquine is the most powerful 50 caliber machine gun if I can't get it? It doesn't help me, it doesn't help my patients. So it could be the best, but it's the worst if I can't use it. So by way of analogy, I consider quercetin a 22 caliber pistol. However, if there's nothing else available, you better believe I'm going to use it. And in certain circumstances, it's more appropriate even in the young, healthy people or low-risk patients where I'm not really worried about death, but I am worried about, let's say, spread, or I'm worried about just misery, people experiencing human misery. So then the quercetin approach is much more appropriate. However, in high-risk patients, I still prefer hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, because these are the 50 caliber machine guns. However, the reality is that in many places I can't get it for people. So then I revert to plan B, which is better than nothing. So that's my answer. Which one's better depends on who you are. But in high risk circumstances, I do prefer the more powerful weapon if I can get it.
Yeah, understood. That's great. So let's talk for a minute about, you know, the progression, which was really quick. So, you know, we went from, you know, Biden and company saying these vaccines, I don't trust them, to now all of a sudden people are being fired from their jobs because they refuse to get this jab. And you can speak freely about this here. What, from a scientific standpoint, when you saw this, what were you saying to yourself when you saw that they were basically creating spike protein factories to walk around all day long, when they had warned us about the spike protein for months and months?
Okay, so now you're shifting to the vaccine approach. Now, there are four aspects to any pandemic response, and I would argue that all four are crucial. The first is spread prevention. I think that's obvious. Number two would be pre-hospital care. In other words, if someone gets sick, it would make sense to intervene early and prevent them from getting sicker. I mean, it's just common sense. Now, if they do end up in the hospital, it also would make sense to have good hospital treatments. And then if there is a good and effective and safe vaccine, I totally recommend the use of vaccines. I'm not anti-vax at all, but I am anti-stupid. And since none of the COVID-19 vaccines that exist as of today, the four most common ones, as I'm sure you know, is Pfizer and Moderna. Those are the mRNA vaccines. And then you have the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson, which are not as popular anymore. But those are the DNA-based vaccines. But all of them, the end result was didn't work, were not medically necessary. And I'll explain that as well. And did a lot more harm and do a lot more harm than good. Just to quickly summarize what these vaccines, the carnage that they've exposed people to, is the following: blood clots, heart inflammation, crazy rates of miscarriages, increases risks of cancer and autoimmune diseases, most likely destruction of ovarian function. And that's child's play compared to the real concern, which is called ADE, or antibody dependent enhancement, which has the world experts screaming genocide. Stop doing it because you're going to kill off humanity with billions of dead. And that's not me saying that. That's world experts, mm-hmm. like Malone, who invented the vaccine, Michael Yeadon, who was the head of Pfizer, vice president of Pfizer, and other people of that. Dr. Luke Montague, who won the Nobel Prize in 2008 for discovering HIV.
No. He's a conspiracy theorist, along with all those other people that you've mentioned, Dr. Zelenko. You can't...
He's not a theorist.
No, I'm making a joke. I'm being sarcastic.
And I'm answering the joke by saying that Noah was a conspiracy theorist in the Bible until it rained.
Yep.
Then he wasn't a theorist anymore. It was just conspiracy. And here we're watching conspiracy to commit genocide, mass murder, and socially reengineer humanity in the mindset of a few psychopathic or sociopathic oligarchs and deranged, devolved pagans. So that's what I consider Bill Gates, George Soros, Klaus Schwab, Zuckerberg, and those are nothing compared to the real people who are organizing this, who are too smart to be in the media. So, because look, there's a handful of people on this planet that have the resources to manipulate industries, such as media, both social and mainstream, academia, politics, and in the industry itself. And you know that around 150 people in the world own around 70% of the corporate wealth of the world.
Before you go on, did you know this before COVID, or is this something that you've just figured out since?
I knew none. I was a country hick doctor, just spending his life trying to treat his patients and raise his family and serve his God and try not to, you know, I didn't have any of those grandiose thoughts. However, it all landed on, it came to me, and out of necessity, I became the tip of the spear of the worst global crime in the history of humanity, and I was able to reverse engineer, put the puzzle pieces together after 18 months to make a pretty convincing story and narrative, true narrative, I think, that explains really what's going on. The people that have done this are absolutely brilliant. They have my respect. They're absolutely evil. I hope they hang at the Hague. But they have my respect in terms of sheer brilliance of how to execute a global takeover, an enslavement of innocent people. And it's brilliant. And then one of the ways they did that is there's a few people that have stakes in industries. And they're, because of their influence over those industries, can manipulate those industries. So, for example, it goes very hand in hand. Academia, for example, if you endow or sponsor, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, they if you look, most of the universities that came out with studies against the use of early intervention, hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, that whole pre-hospital approach, all of them, when you get down to their support are getting support from China and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which exactly is the main supporters of WHO. So it's not surprising that academia will get on its knees and open its mouth to serve their masters. You know what I'm saying? And sorry for the imagery, but that's exactly what's going on.
Perfect imagery. It's fine.
And that goes the same with the pharmaceutical industry, and it goes the same with politics. For example, the FDA doesn't serve the American public. You'd think it would, except that if you look at the two last commissioners of the FDA, one was Stephen Hahn, who I mentioned, I spoke to personally. He now, I believe, works for Moderna. And the other idiot before that, Scott Gottlieb, works for Pfizer. So the FDA is a whorehouse. FDA just sells out influence, gives approvals. The pharmaceutical industry funds 50%, if not more, of the budget of the FDA. What do you expect? Objectivity? Mm-hmm. And then their top echelon goes works for the pharmaceutical industry. So there's no firewall. So how can you trust anything that the FDA says? I want to develop that idea because I think it's absolutely repugnant how the interests of the American people and the interests of decent humanity. We've been raped without lubrication. And I'll tell you how. Once President Trump, after he got information about hydroxychloroquine, in part due to my work, came out with an executive order that he wants hydroxychloroquine made available to every single American, period. And he issued that executive order to Secretary Azar, who was the Secretary of Health and Human Services, HHS. He gave it over to, passed the buck to Larry Kudlow, I believe his name was, mm-hmm. who was chief counsel for HHS. And he gave it over to Dr. Rick Not-So-Bright, Rick Bright, who self-incriminates himself. Rick Bright was the head of BARDA. BARDA is a division of the HHS involved in bioweapons research and also vaccine development. It's interesting that it does both. And he's in a documentary called Totally Under Control, which came out in November of 2020, right before the election. And the reason why I know about this documentary, I was in it myself. And in the segment right before mine, Rick Bright gives an interview. And what I'm about to do is paraphrase his own words. Anyone could look it up. He says like this, that he got the order from basically essentially the president. He did not agree with that order. And his team at BARDA didn't agree with that order. Now, what was that order? They were supposed to take hydroxychloroquine, apply the right to try legislation pathways that had been developed and championed for by Senator Ron Johnson from Wisconsin. And the right to try legislation was a pathway designed to make investigational medications or drugs that are not approved but could be used off-label made available to average Americans outside of clinical trials. That was the whole point of that right to try legislation. And BARDA and Rick Bright was tasked to use that as a mechanism to make hydroxychloroquine available by opening up the national stockpiles of hydroxychloroquine to every single American. And so what Rick Bright said, and again, these are his own words, they did not agree with that order, so they came up with a creative solution to limit access of hydroxychloroquine to the American public. I'll say it again. It's very important that you understand what I just said. He said they did not agree with the president's order, so they sabotaged the president's order and intent, and instead of using the right to try legislation, they issued an emergency use authorization that restricted access to hydroxychloroquine to hospitalized patients only. Now, if you've been listening to anything that I've said from the beginning of this interview, I said that it's early into, within the first few days of the onset of symptoms, yep. prevents all the disease. This monster, this primordial serpent incarnate, this embodied devil, Rick Bright and his team, literally created obstacles to access to life-saving medication.
I've experienced this firsthand several times. I've worked with several families in this position, even now today. It's evil. It's pure evil what's happening in this country right now.
They even have been working to cover things up by fudging the numbers with the vaccine when they know that 80% of the people who have died directly after the vaccine die within 2 weeks. Now they made this rule that you're not considered vaccinated until 2 weeks after your last shot. So there's all types of things like this going on right now that just contributes to this overall evil, you know, delivery of this plan. It's unreal.
And then
the mechanisms of genocide. You see, I agree with your assessment, but I'm actually giving you the pathway to prosecution of these criminals. I'm actually describing to you in detail the step-by-step machinations of mass murder. And I'm providing you the evidence. Any prosecutor, anyone who is listening to this, could just do their due diligence and go look up the words of Rick Bright on this documentary, Totally Under Control. We'll see the guy gloats. He gloats that he blocked access of hydroxychloroquine to the American public. By the way, he is now running a department for the Rockefeller Foundation. Just so you know.
And therein lies the problem. Who is holding anyone accountable? That's the thing that we've been screaming about for years now. None of these people are held accountable by anyone. Actually,
no one will hold them accountable unless you and me hold them accountable. Mm-hmm. And this is the point that people have to realize. You know, if you go back 80 years ago, one Nazi with a German Shepherd and one machine gun could corral 2,000 Jews to their death in a gas chamber. So one obvious question is, well, why didn't they just turn around and trample the guy? It's true, the people in the inner circle would probably get shot and killed, but at least the rest of the people would live. Why is it that people didn't they just walk like sheep, literally, to get their necks cut, their throats cut? And the answer is because of a gradual process of psychological warfare and moral, demoralization and isolation and fear, people lose their resolve to live. They lose resolve to rise up against tyranny. And that's exactly what's happened. The enemies of humanity are very afraid of the following. They're afraid of you and me working in unison. They're afraid of organized resistance. They're afraid because there's many more of us than them. And by the way, if you want to see what a complacent defeatist country looks like, just have to look at Australia right now. Australia has already built concentration camps, quarantine facilities, they call them, or gulags, where they're going to forcibly relocate people that are refusing to get vaccinated. They're putting ankle bracelets on people who are refusing to get vaccinated. They're physically abusing and torturing people that are refusing to get vaccinated. And the only difference between us and Australia is that we have 450 million guns. And the reason why Biden's administration has not sent its stormtroopers into your house to forcibly hold you down and inject you is they know that the American public has 450 million guns. If they try that stuff with the American public, there's going to be different types of shots being given. American public, this will be a rise to another civil war. American public will not allow for its own children to get slaughtered by policies of a few tyrannical sociopathic despots.
So you think, then you're encouraged, like I am, believe it or not, I am encouraged. I'm not putting words in your mouth. Disagree with me if you want. I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing going on with people standing their ground, specifically in the medical field, and letting this termination come upon their heads and their families and not, you know, caving in to this tyranny and causing the problems they're causing right now for large medical establishments.
What are they going to do? Fire all of you? All of us?
Well, that's exactly what I've been saying.
Are they going to imprison all of us? They're going to expel everyone from school? You see, what's happening, it's only now where we're still divided that they have this perception of power. In reality, look, normal society, normal human beings, I would even say the pathway towards the divine is wanting that your children should have a better life and experience than you had. Every parent aspires for their children to have more and be better than they were. That brings parents joy. That's normal society. Pagan societies or evil societies do the exact opposite. They sacrifice their own children for their own benefit. So what's the difference if I cut the throat of a child, or I throw a child off a cliff, or I throw a child into a volcano, or I take a child that has a near 100% chance of recovery from COVID-19 with no treatment and inject them with a liquid that will kill 100 times more children than the actual virus that we're trying to protect the child from. Dr. Michael Yeadon, who was the vice president of Pfizer, you heard that company, Pfizer? It's a little company. And he also was the head of their vaccine development program, said that for every one child that naturally, he told this to me personally, he's a friend of mine. So I spoke to him because I wanted to confirm that this is really what he's saying before I go global with it. And he did confirm it, that for every one child that dies naturally from COVID, 100 die from the vaccine.
This is the kind of crap that keeps me up every night. This is generally all we talk about lately on the show and for the past 6-8 months with this shot.
So what kind of society murders its own children? And the answer is the pagan society.
Yeah.
You see, really, there's nothing new under the sun. These devolved pagans, you know, they perceive themselves as to be intellectually advanced or philosophically or theologically. They experience a new level of consciousness, and that empowers them to dictate how the rest of us should live, how many of us should be on the planet, how long we should live, and so on. And what that really is a denial of the divine element of man. It's the denial that God creates us in his image. Our lives are sanctity, and it's not within the purview of decrepit flesh to decide how many of us should live on the planet and how long we should live. But these devolved pagans think exactly the opposite. They think they're God. They want to be deities. You know, the whole world literally is suffering because Bill Gates could not find a girlfriend in high school. It's the revenge of the nerds. It's really what's happening here is these narcissists who were abused as kids and who are now have billions of dollars, and technocrats who really are in a position to inflict revenge and their hatred of themselves and of others. And that's exactly what's going on. They make themselves feel better when they walk on your graves.
It is just 150, like you said. It's really crazy that finally people are learning this. There have been a lot of folks screaming about it for decades, but it's all coming to a head now. And I have a positive outlook on what's going to happen from here, because you're right. What are they going to do? Do it to all of us? No. And there's enough of us to still stand up and stop it. What's your major focus right now? I mean, obviously, you're doing a ton of interviews in media, but what are you focused on?
I'm focused on, I might have to go in another minute. I have another interview now, but I'm focused on spreading information to the public that empowers them to take their health care into their own hands and that of their families and not let tyrannical forces destroy you. And the answer is very simple. Just go to any vitamin shop and buy the following stuff. You can find it all on my website, or you can buy my product if you want to, but you don't have to, because you can put it together yourself, maybe even save a few dollars, which is the following. Get quercetin, Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Get a zinc, vitamin C, and vitamin D. By the way, vitamin D levels are should be between 50 and 70. That's high normal. If you have high normal levels of vitamin D, you essentially stay out of the intensive care units. All the data shows that people with high normal levels of vitamin D do not get that sick. So that's important. So in the winter, people get sick in part because it's a viral season, but it's also low vitamin D season. So your defenses are low. So vitamin D is absolutely essential, not only for COVID-19, but for general overall health. And then vitamin C helps also prime your immune system, and it works together with quercetin to get zinc inside the cell. The zinc inhibits RNA-dependent RNA polymerase. So it's a very effective strategy. There is another substance besides a quercetin. It's something called EGCG, which is a green tea extract also available over the counter, and does the same exact thing. So if your government or your doctor is evil, which most of them are, what I recommend is don't delay treatment. Don't ask the government for permission. Be proactive. Get the necessary tools to stay alive into your house before you get sick. If you're in the high-risk category, if you're over the age of 45 or you have medical problems, or unfortunately, if you took the vaccine, you should be on prophylaxis. And then if you do get sick on day one, just start aggressive treatment. And I have all the protocols on my website for the exact dosing if you want it. It's VladimirZelenkoMD.com. VladimirZelenkoMD.com. That's my website. It has for free all the dosing and the protocols. And so if you do that, you've significantly improved your chances of, first of all, not suffering that much if you do get COVID, and preventing hospitalization and death. Nothing is 100%. I can't promise anything, but I can tell you with certainty, if you intervene early, your outcomes will be much better.
I have to thank you. I'd really like to have you back at some point to talk about more of the philosophy behind all this stuff and get more in depth about that. It's been a pleasure having you, and I'm sure our audience is going to feel the same way. You have this Z-Stack supplement available. I would recommend people support you. So if you want to get everything all in one place, I have a couple friends that are taking it already, and they rave about it. So thanks for doing that for everybody.
Thanks for the support. And you should know, I open sourced all this information. I made it available. I didn't want to monetize it at all, actually. But what happened was that people had trouble sourcing everything. And there's a lot of questions. It's a puzzle to get to put together. And, you know, when you have in Russia, it was very simple. When it came to food, it was yes or no. You know, you didn't have options. So either you ate what they had or you didn't eat. The problem in America, thank God, is that we have so much choices, so many choices that, so when I say get vitamin C, I get 100 questions, which vitamin C? When I say get zinc, which zinc? So it became impossible. People had too many questions, too many uncertainties to put the puzzle together. And they also had trouble sourcing everything in one place. You know, like not every pharmacy or a vitamin shop had everything. So I was asked to put everything in one pill, make it easy for people, which I did. And it's exactly in the dosing that I recommend. So it kind of evolved from being an open sourced information to creating a product that is a matter of convenience and logistically much simpler for people to get. And people are very grateful for that.
Yeah, they are. That's absolutely true. Doctor, thank you. I know you have another interview. Thanks so much for joining us today. I'll send you a copy of this when it's done.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks, Tracy.
Thank you.
Really, thank you.
I'm Jerry P. Tuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.